Hi, everybody. This is Pete Brown, and I'm here with some folks from the RIA Services team. How you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. And you have the extra comfy chair.
And some cushions.
Some cushions. Look at this. This is a pretty swank office here. Is this, who is this? This is Jeff's office, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. Except I didn't see any popcorn, so I didn't know if it was yours or not. So tell me about what you guys just shipped. First of all, what is RIA Services?
RIA Services is essentially a way of building end-to-end applications using .NET Framework in Silverlight. It's a set of tools that makes it simple to build your application, rich internet application, with these sets of technologies.
Cool. And so what did each of you guys do on that project? Like, you know, what's your role and who are you?
I'm Jeff Handley. I'm a developer on the team. I joined just over 2 years ago. So the project was still pretty new when I started. It was maybe 6 months or a year in or something like that. And I started off actually on the navigation framework and then moved over and worked on several different sort of experimental things, validation, worked on the data annotation stack, actually got that built into Silverlight 3.
Cool.
So we were able to get that in ahead of time so we can continue to build on top of that. Then I moved over and started working on the domain data source control and worked further on validation stack and a lot on the client side, trying to make sure that the client pieces all tie together and kind of published off the top half of the stack.
Very cool. And what about you, sir?
I'm Dinesh Kulkarni. I'm PM lead on RIA Services. I've been on RIA Services since its very inception. Basically, the language integrated query or link project evolved into RIA Services. It was called something else. We had a lot of code names before, but that's what it evolved into. That was 2.5 years ago.
Wow. So this has been going on quite a while then.
Certainly.
Yeah, I remember it survived several different names at least.
Exactly. It went from Rialto to Alexandria to .NET RIA Services to finally WCF RIA Services.
Wow, great. And you, sir?
I'm Dipesh Manani. I'm a program manager on the RIA Services team.
All right, so you're the suit?
So I actually own the domain data source, the validation, the toolkit, set of pieces of RIA Services, including the release pieces and managing the dependencies with different technologies we have here in Microsoft.
Great, great. So obviously the team is bigger than just you three guys. So tell me a little bit about how the team was structured and, you know, how you built things and, you know, just give us a little bit of information into how you guys get stuff done.
I think we have about, seven devs?
I think at the peak we had nine.
Nine devs and about 8 or 9 tests in the QA side. So it's basically one. And we had 3 PMs on the RIA Services team. Back then we also had the RIA client, what we used to call, which was the data form, data grid team. So that kind of split out and went into RIA, SDK, and you have the RIA Services team is now about a team of 20 people, I would say. 20?
Yeah. And plus, you shouldn't forget, you've had a full-time architect on it.
Correct.
Nikhil Kothari, whose blog you might have seen.
Yep.
Presentations as well. We've had a lot of external help that does not come from within the team. For example, we have designer help that's not part of the set of people that Dipesh mentioned.
Right.
We've got excellent sort of UI-related stuff created by them. We've got usability engineers sort of helping us part-time.
Wow.
They help on multiple components, so they're not just on this. But they've helped on it, and then security and everything. There are lots of these infrastructure teams that sort of help multiple components and spend a few cycles.
Did I catch that correctly? Did you say you had pretty much one-to-one test devs and devs? I mean,
sure.
It's a fair one-to-one, I would say. Yeah.
Actually, it's even more in favor of tests if you count the vendors.
Right.
There's some work that is done by the vendors for us, so they're not part of the regular normal team necessarily. But it's the normal team is one-to-one and then some vendors. So there's a lot of testing that goes into it. I know you guys find bugs in the community, and we're glad you do, but we try our best to test it on multiple configurations, multiple Visual Studio skills and whatnot.
That's pretty impressive. You know, I've worked on a lot of projects before I joined Microsoft, and, you know, if you had a couple testers on the team for a pretty large team, you know, even if they were developer or tester type roles like what's here, that was considered a pretty good ratio. But that's nice to see that testing is taken pretty seriously.
Yeah, fortunate enough.
Yeah.
And let's not forget Brad Abrams, who's now probably at Google I.O. today,
I think so, too.
Yeah, he's promised me a Nexus one. But
yeah, one of the things that really impressed me coming to this team was both the testers and the PMs are so technical that, you know, since we're building framework things, in order to test it, you have to build an application in order to test it. And it's different from the testers that I've been used to in the past projects building products. Mm-hmm. So coming here and seeing people build full working applications that we can use internally and kind of dog food our own software and framework on top of products built by our testers and PMs, it's a neat atmosphere.
Yeah.
And I think I saw during in one of the emails that there were 8 product units involved in
exactly
Alexandria start to finish. So.
And there's also the BizApps team, which we, that delivered the whole drag and drop experience.
Right.
Where you, the data sources and integration. So they also had a huge aspect in lighting up RIA services in Visual Studio.
Right.
Yeah, partner teams are always critical for these products because what you use is not a standalone component. You use a set of things that work together, and a lot of different teams come together, collaborate extensively, and work together to produce the final experience that you see. And the page is pointing out that we had Visual Studio expertise mm-hmm. from other teams coming in and helping us.
Exactly.
We had same from Silverlight core team itself helped us a lot. CLR team helped us. So there were a lot of influences and help and kind of review and critiquing that happened.
Right. Yeah. But that's not free, though. I mean, you take a dependency on some of those projects, right? I mean, so, like, what did you guys end up taking dependencies on in this, and how did that affect you?
One thing that's real easy to point out is Silverlight 4.
Right.
We were able to, you know, over the course of a year, work toward iNotify data error info. And that's an interface that allows for asynchronous validation
mm-hmm.
and very rich management of validation errors inside entities. It took a very long time to get to that. And we started...
Well, it's a really long interface name, so it takes a long time to get...
That's right. And, you know, as Dipesh mentioned, you know, long ago our team actually had the DataGrid and Dataform guys were on our team, and we kind of split, and they went over to Silverlight SDK. And so we've been working with those guys since Silverlight 2. I think we were still Silverlight 1.1 when I first joined. I helped this kind of adopt Silverlight 2 and then 3 and then, you know, requirements in 4. So we, of course, had to take a dependency on Silverlight 4.
Right.
And it's neat seeing those features that we drive into Silverlight kind of come to fruition and then be able to build on top of them.
Yeah, and let's not forget .NET 4 and Visual Studio 2010 as well. In .NET 4, we had to actually get a feature added in order to make RIA services work properly. And we didn't have that feature in .NET 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
And partial trust support was a really key and important thing that we heard from the community again and again. Some said it so strongly, they said, don't bother shipping if you don't have partial trust support.
Wow, yeah.
And that support, frankly, required additional work in the core framework itself. And that's what is in .NET 4.
So how does that work? I mean, I'm assuming one of you guys just don't suddenly go and drag down the .NET 4 branch and start checking in changes. I mean... do you have somebody over there who, you know, you've negotiated with and they start building a feature for you? Or?
So it's a partner team dependency. As I think in this case, we had ASP.NET, who was our partner team. So we started negotiating with them and talking to them about our requirements. And we came up with a design plan. And once we got that vetted out, there's a whole different process of getting it checked in into the .NET 4. It's not easy. So you have to go through a bunch of processes and quality gates. And there are a lot of exit criteria that need to be met before it's... gets injected into .NET 4.
Right.
Once that happened, then only we could have moved to .NET 4. So I think there's... RIA services actually has a lot of dependencies. People, you know, think... I kind of alluded about this in my channel line, but there is a lot of dependency. We have dependency on Visual Studio itself
mm-hmm.
for our code generation. We have dependencies on .NET 4, ASP.NET, Silverlight 4. There's... Am I missing?
Those are sort of the main ones.
Yeah.
And getting anything in framework... Once it's in the framework, it's there forever.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of scrutiny about getting anything added. A lot of questions are asked, and you have to justify it, and you have to make sure that what you're doing is, you know, secure, and you go through security reviews, localization-related work, and everything.
Right.
And that's what, only then you get to ship. It's sort of a privilege to ship.
Right.
And you have to earn that privilege by showing that you've got a good need and good way of doing your work.
Yeah. I've heard that about the framework and about Windows. You know, either... if you want to ship something with either of those products, that's, you know, you have to go through some pretty rigorous testing and pretty good process to get that in there.
Exactly.
Cool. Hey, so one of the things that I hear a lot in the community is, look, Microsoft, you've given us all this great stuff, but I have no clue as to how to use it, right? You know, when do I use this data type as opposed to another? When do I use this type of validation versus another? Do you guys have any guidance to offer the community for anything related to RIA services?
Yeah, it's one thing that we do hear a little bit about is that our documentation is a little scattered right now. And I think a lot of it is blogging has been embraced more and more. And even just the 2 years that I've been here, I see a lot more blogging going on. You know, more and more members on our team are starting blogs. But as we're all sort of putting this information out there on our own, it does make it a little hard to kind of aggregate it back together. And that's something that, you know, we're actually talking to you about, with, you know, Pete, and trying to find ways to aggregate that stuff together. And it'd be great to hear more from the community on where do you want to find that stuff? Where do you want to go? How do you want to find that stuff? And, you know, is MSDN the right place? Is Silverlight.net the right place? Or, you know, it's hard to...
Of course, both of those places are excellent locations to put this stuff, in case my boss is listening in on the phone. Cool. So that's where you put it. Now let's talk a little bit about you know, some actual guidance that you might have from folks. Like, what are some best practices around Rio services?
Sure. So I think the best place to start is to think about what it is that you get to build with Rio services. What you come into with the project is you've already got some idea of what your data is. Typically, you have a source of data, be it database or a set of web services. You've got some sort of a data access layer. You know how to access it.
Yep.
And then you start working with Rio services. So at that point, you start thinking about your business logic. What is the logic that I want in my application? What queries am I going to allow? What access to my data am I going to allow? And what kinds of checks I'm going to perform when you make changes to the data and I get it back? And that's sort of the right way to think about it. Think about it as a layer of business logic between sort of the traditional services pieces, whether it's, you know, your HTTP stack or something else, and data access layer on the one side. And when you really think about it from that point of view, everything starts coming together much better. Of course, you could do it from a UI-first way as well.
Right.
And think about the tasks user is going to do, what data each task is going to require, and then build out your domain service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where the prescriptive guidance starts, which is think about the logic that you need. Whether you think about it from a model standpoint, whether you think about it from the UI-first standpoint. But do think about it. That's
right.
Where the core of your application should be. That's the value. That's where your business logic lives, and that's what needs to evolve over time.
Right. That's one thing I've liked about Rio Services is it's pretty much agnostic as to, you know, what the back end is, and really only the tooling is prescriptive on the front end right now.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it occupies the middle, and that's really all you guys care about.
Right. Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right. So you mentioned some stuff about the model and some pieces there for objects that you put in there. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And do you have any guidance around, you know, exposing model entities or, you know, lots of, one of the big patterns that's out right now is model view view model, right? And there's a whole question about, do I pass model entities straight through front to back? Do I expose subsets of model entities? Do I expose, you know, like, do you have anything that's specific to Rio services that kind of lends some help to that?
There's some obvious starting points before I hand over to the two experts on my side about view model, which is when you start with the model, the whole model is meant to capture your data, the valuable data that you have, but it's not necessarily meant to be used by the user. It's an overload to expose the entire model.
Yep.
So think about which entities, so to use the user, Rio services speak, which entities the user really cares about. If they're working with purchase order, that's what you should expose. Don't expose unnecessary entities that shouldn't be exposed.
Yep.
Very kind of common sense type stuff, but good to have as a checklist. Then make sure that you're really only exposing the operations you should. There's no reason to support an update operation on an entity that you don't want the user to update.
Right.
And so don't go with, you know, I've got all these this interesting model, how can I build a UI around it? Think about the tasks the user want to do, and then write the methods that correspond to exactly the level of data that they need. If they don't need some piece of data, just don't expose it to start with.
Right. So don't just go ahead and build this and... You know, you take your database, expose everything that's out of the database as entities, and then make CRUD operations for every single one of those. I mean, that's definitely sounds like kind of an anti-pattern for in general.
There's a place for database browsers, and we have two great tools to do that. Rio Services is not meant for you to write database browsers.
Right.
And also, if you expose entities or update operations on a particular entity, and you only want an admin or a manager to do that, so make sure you put the right attributes, which is the requires attribute of the requires authentication attribute or the requires role attribute on those methods. So only that user can actually call those methods.
Exactly.
And I know that I've heard a lot of people in the community using data transfer objects or DTOs with Rio services. And instead of exposing their raw entities, they're using DTO and using Rio services to expose their DTOs. That way you can, we've got a feature called presentation model. I'm not sure. I know that's what we call the feature. I don't know what the community would refer to it. How would you?
It's called differently. It basically, the whole purpose is not to expose your DALL type to your client. So basically, if your DALL type changes, you don't want to go rev up your UI. So that's the whole feature. What that does is basically you can have a CLR type on your domain service, which a domain service returning your CLR type, and you basically populate the data in it, and
okay.
actually push that back.
Not to be confused with the presentation model pattern, right? I mean, this right. is, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of loosely modeled after that. The idea was that you would create a CLR shape that matches the presentation model that you need
okay.
in your task. And you can form that shape on the server and expose that through RIA services up to the client.
Very
that
nice.
Way, on the client side, you get the natural shape of the entities that you're dealing with. I shouldn't
right.
even say entities at that point. The
right.
just the POCOs, really.
Right. Yeah.
And then you map that back and forth through the DTO on the server side.
And there is a, basically, even if you have APIs that you can actually call into where you have auto-generated fields in the database, like last modified date, for example.
Right.
And that's updated in the database, you can actually flow that back all the way to your client using
mm-hmm.
this presentation model. We basically, you pass in instances, and we pass you back those instances, and you can do the update on the reserve methods.
That's pretty nice.
I would take an extreme position, I would say you always have a presentation model. The question is, what does the presentation model look like?
Right.
It could look like a subset of your data model or your object model that you use on the mid-tier, or it could look more elaborate, like the ones that Dipesh and Jeff already mentioned,
mm-hmm.
which is a separate set of classes.
Right.
You essentially have some shaping that has to be done because your entire database is not really meant to be edited by the end user.
Right.
Yeah.
If that was the case, you would just expose the whole database.
Right.
And right.
you wouldn't need
and the,
here, have query analyzer. Go at it.
The real critical part is ultimately you just need to have a key attribute,
right.
one of the properties on the POCOs that you create.
Right.
By having that key, that allows RIA services to manage all the entities on the client side
right.
and send the changes back over to the server. And, decorate with
yeah.
other metadata beyond that, you know, with like the editable attribute. If you need to make something not editable, don't use the read-only attribute. Use the editable attribute.
Right,
but,
right.
It's quite editable, actually. So.
plug. I cover that in my book. Yeah. Anyway, one of the things that I remember from being involved in the Alexandria stuff early on, like as a person in the community, was you guys were really open, like with changes that you were doing. I mean. We were seeing new builds of stuff constantly. We had weekly meetings with discussions like, how are you guys using this? You know, what do we need to change? And the product itself changed an awful lot during that time. I remember, you know, you would try stuff out, the community would say, nah, and you guys would just go ahead and come up with a better way to do it. And so it was very impressive to me. Like, so coming at it from your side, like, how did community feedback and how did, you know, the community in general impact what you guys were doing?
No, I think, from my perspective, the WCF alignment, I think, was one of the biggest things. When I started on the project, it was RIA Services had a proprietary communication stack. And I'd heard rumors that at one point we were built on top of Astoria and built on top of WCF and then proprietary again and then Astoria. And it's like,
that wasn't true?
That wasn't true. That was not at all true. We were HTTP handler for a good long time before we moved to WCF.
Oh, my God. It made a great story, though.
But it is, you know, we did hear a lot of feedback that there was confusion with RIA Services and WCF and what was the right thing. And once we stepped back and looked at that again, we saw that WCF was the right thing to build on top of. And Wilco Bauer on our team did a fantastic job taking the proprietary stack out and plugging this in on top of WCF. And now we get all the same extensibility points as WCF. And I think it's great the way shaped up.
And the one way to think of RIA Services is like just a higher programming model over WCF. Like, you don't have to go write your service contracts. We do that for you. You just have
yep.
your business logic, and we just expose that as a WCF
mm-hmm.
service.
But Pete is absolutely right. I mean, beyond just, you know, WCF-based RIA Services implementation, we had a lot of feedback from community all the way through. For example, we shaped our named update methods, they were called custom methods,
mm-hmm.
In concert with discussions with community. We shaped our convention based on some feedback from community. Of course, there was mixed feedback, and sometimes you get conflicting feedback, so you have to sort of decide, you know, who's got compelling arguments and who's sort of looking at the breadth
right.
of developers. And so that's always a difficult choice, but there was this feedback constantly for a year and a half about everything from names of the methods to the, you know, whole notion of how architecturally they're laid out to, you know, what features we really need to build first versus next, to what platforms we need to support. Making the trade-offs, we always did that in consultation with community.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we had a very difficult choice about whether to continue to invest in 3.5 or to really get the 4.0-based features out, .NET 4 and Silverlight 4 features out. And we heard from really influential folks in the community, you know, Pete Spears, who said, yes, we would love to have 3.5 support, but in the end, you must get it right. And if that requires a change in the framework and in Visual Studio and in Silverlight, then so be it. That's what you need to pursue. Mm-hmm. And when we hear this kind of, you know, strong advice from people that we trust and those who've been using our bits, that carries a lot of weight. And yep. That's how we sort of make our investment decisions, well informed by what the community says.
I think another component that went, which had a lot of community feedback, was domain data source. Mm-hmm. And Jeff had done a...
I remember lots of heated phone calls about domain data source. It's funny.
So it went through, I think, a bunch of iterations. There was one point we actually opened up a lot of scenarios where you can deal with domain data source. And
right.
I think one of the feedbacks we got was it was unpredictable.
Yeah. We started to let you change pages while you had pending changes on the client.
Right.
And if you added something, it might push it over and onto the next page or delete something that goes to the previous page. And yeah, the feedback goes, no, just lock that stuff down, cut that feature, and make it more predictable.
We did that in the November preview where we actually locked it down and gave you fairly control. Like, you can do stuff, but you can control in a controlled fashion.
Right.
And that was one of the features we got. I think the business application template also got some community feedback as well, but
right. That's
where we went to the community and asked us, okay, fine, what is the common thing in your application that you build? And login was one of them. There was other pieces as well, but we decided to go with login because that's completely agnostic of your database, and we could actually create that template.
Right. Yeah, I was just impressed that everybody on the team was able to be dragged into a conference room on, like, what, it was like 8 o'clock in the morning on Fridays, I think it was what it was. So
I have to admit, I used to be late for those sometimes.
Oh, see.
I used to call it.
All right. So there's actually, like, Brad and two other people in the room is what it came.
Right.
And a bunch of speakerphones. Yeah, all right, I understand now. You've totally shattered my image of the team's productivity. I thought you guys were dedicated to it.
We're here till 9 p.m., though.
Yeah. Some of us were thought about actually staying on for the call and then going home after that.
Yeah.
Because of meetings thereafter, we couldn't do that. That wouldn't have been too hard for us.
I remember there was one weekend that was, I was 2 months into the Real Services team where we had a 24-hour turnaround where I know Jeff was here till 3 a.m., or 4 a.m., yeah. And then Ron, who's a developer in our team, he gets in at 5 a.m. every day.
Yeah.
So we had like a 24 hours, like, dev working on this particular feature.
Nice, nice.
I think component model data annotations, was it?
Yeah. Infamous data annotations.
Yeah. But yeah, these days are great, so.
Now I understand why the vending machines in the rooms here are stocked so well.
That's right. Nice. And the free boat.
But you know, if I had a couch like this in my office, I would stay till 3 in the morning, too. Hey, so let's close this with a little bit of info on what your favorite features are. So I'm going to put you guys on the spot, and I'll put Jeff on the spot first.
You know,
what's your favorite feature?
I'd have to say of all the features I've seen from resources, our inheritance support is one of my favorite things. We didn't support inheritance until November, mm-hmm. I think, is when we had our first mm-hmm. preview of it. That was something we had a lot of dependencies on .NET 4. So
yep.
when we had our first .NET 4 release there in November, we were able to preview that feature. Ron Kane, that Dipesh just mentioned, I remember him coming and giving a demo to the team of our inheritance support, and I was very pessimistic about how it's going to shape up, and I saw the demo and was just blown away.
Oh, I thought you were saying you were pessimistic during the demo.
It blew my mind what he was able to pull off, the way you can have one inheritance structure in the server, but you can choose which levels you want to expose to the client, and then kind of flatten or explode it back out on the client. And I know that we had a lot of early feedback asking for inheritance, and I really feel like we nailed that one. So
nice.
I'm real proud of that one, even though I didn't touch it.
What about you, sir?
For me, validation has to be the one.
Yeah.
It's just doing the declarative validation and doing the other one. Doing custom validations, writing your own methods, being able to call that. I just worked on it. I still like the feature. Even though but, you know.
Yeah.
I
don't know that I trust any code Jeff wrote, but that's okay.
From a productivity perspective, that really gives you a significant boost.
Yeah, I agree. I really do like the validation attributes and being able to create your own custom validators, and they hang off so easily on that. Yeah, I like that a lot.
By the way, the inheritance feature has to be one of the most expensive ones. And I was the one, for full disclosure, saying, let's not do it. I'd done it in like the SQL, and I knew what it cost. It usually costs 3x of what you estimate.
Yeah.
Now, in this case, we had great developer Ron, so... We managed to pull it off, but I was very apprehensive going in.
Great. And yourself?
I think it's a toss-up for me. It's the WCF angle of things and domain data source. And many people in the community think domain data source is a bad in writing XAML, but I think what it offers is pretty good.
Yeah.
It lets you get started if you're a new person, you're not familiar with MVVM. Mm-hmm. It lets you get started on how to create a basic primary business application.
You mean it's not an evil conspiracy?
It's not an evil conspiracy.
It's not an evil dumb developer.
And we're not capturing your data.
We won't let Sean watch this video.
I vowed to Sean that in version 2 I would make him like Command Data Source. And I actually just, we've got our user voice site out there. I actually just added another feature onto that, kind of helping get there. I have some ideas for how to break Command Data Source apart so you don't have to put it in Vue.
Failing those, a baseball bat to the knees until he says he likes domain data source. Yeah, that'll work.
Sean is a scary guy, so I need to
learn more about him. Another aspect was the WCF, because what Rear Service Domain Service is a WCF service.
Yep.
The fact that I can actually add different endpoints to it and talk to it from a Windows phone or a WPF or even an Ajax client, I think that's a pretty kick-ass feature in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so. Cool. Well, thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.